As that's coming up, I don't know if I ever said, my name is Dr. Erin Mon. I am the Director of Research for the National Association of School Nurses. Before that, I was faculty at Brigham Young University in Utah, so some of my research still happens to be in Utah, but I am now in Silver Spring, and hopefully all is going well with the storm. I have nothing to disclose other than I work for NASN. So I have my slides prepared, but as I've listened to everything, I kind of am trying to hope that maybe we can tie some of these things together, because some of the databases I'm going to talk about are ones that are existing that, even though we focus with school nursing, it doesn't mean that just a school nurse always has to do it, and actually that's where we're one of our struggles in some respects. So I'm going to talk about some of the outcomes that do have to do with school health and school nursing. I'm hoping that by the end of this presentation, as well as with the others, I know many of you are already collecting information, and that's great. If you're not, maybe you'll have a few ideas of where you can start, as of not only what to collect, but where you can collect it, and where, as it demonstrated today, there's a lot already being collected, so not hopefully having to start from scratch. So getting that plan together. This first part with the school nurse's outcome is some research that myself and Dr. Martha Berggren, who is the chair of the school health section and was actually the director of research before me. We kind of switched places. She went to academia. We've been working on this because any of you that work in school health, it's hard to justify sometimes with budgets of why is school health needed, any aspect of school health, and that includes school nursing. And with that being our background, is being able to make sure we're collecting the kind of data that's going to give us the outcomes that we needed, as have been mentioned before. And in school nursing, it gets a little bit more difficult because there's many things that are great in the school, but to say it's the school nurse that makes the difference, going back to what Dr. Porwood said with absences and GPA, I mean, we can influence that, but to say, I mean, we think we're pretty great, but to give ourselves that much credit, you know, we realize there's a lot of confounding factors, and that makes research difficult oftentimes, but it's also why it's important to really find out what are the things that, in this case, are really that a school nurse makes a difference for. At the same time, not forgetting that there's a lot of things that the school nurse, as well as many others working together, can have some great health outcomes too. So they're kind of there. They're both there. But what we found as we started going together, we identified 57 potential. Now, we certainly weren't going to collect data on 57 right off the bat, of course. So we thought, we had this idea, we'd pull people together and do a Delphi study, which was you've got the 57 and you'd get... We were going to use school nursing experts to kind of like weigh in, decide, yeah, that's really important. And again, not that they're all important, but the idea being that it's really sensitive to what a school nurse would do. Because there's a lot of great things out there, but to say it's the school nurse that made the difference, that's what we were looking at. The problem was, and I'll use, because we've been using absenteeism this session, we'll start with that. There are so many different definitions of what it means to be absent. That's we're starting there with our biggest struggle. I see head shaking. You know, I mean, each state's collected differently. Even within a state, a district will collect it. Is it if the child came after 10, where they really, you know, or left before a certain time, or how does that all correlate? And because people collect it differently, when we're looking at it from a national standpoint, it really makes it difficult in trying to compare them. Something as simple as we think absenteeism would be. So then you get going on our list, and it just got more and more intense and complex. So something that we thought we would have done probably a year ago, we haven't even gotten to that point of getting the weigh-in of the experts because we haven't been able to get definitions down so that we can be talking on the same page. As I already mentioned, there's also so many factors that influence academic and health outcomes. For us, we were looking specifically at school nursing, and so that just complicates it, as well as what we're hoping to do is to have this so for the long-lasting impact, so we can build on what Katie's doing with the database and make sure that we're collecting things that we can prove with the outcomes. So we want to make sure everything is starting right from it, and so we're delayed. But I will give you some of the potential, the ones, and some of these, like I say, I've already mentioned absenteeism. That will still probably be a factor somehow, but again, we've got to get the correct definition. And then also we have to look at, it's not always, there has been research that has shown that when there is a school nurse in this school, that children oftentimes aren't sent early. So is it really absenteeism we want, or is it seat time, which is what academics use a lot now, is actual seat time. Because if you've got a child that's been in the health room all day, they aren't absent, they're there, but you know, they're not learning, they're not in their seat. So we've got to look at that to see what's really going to be the more specific. Then case management of chronic diseases are there. These are just some of them that that we're looking at. And actually what I'm going to do now is kind of shift gears slightly to say how we already are using some data that already exists to look at some of these outcomes. Some of them specific to school nursing, some of them not necessarily, but when the, in the world in which we are, population health and school health, we thought might be beneficial for everyone. And also show some examples of what we're talking about with trying to get a national sample. We got to get on the same page first. So the first example is obesity. I know that was our first presenter. This is a project that in Utah, we don't collect data on individual children regarding obesity, but every 3 years, the state health department does a random study of all the school. They randomize the schools that are going to be used across the state, and then first graders, third graders, and fifth graders are measured, and it's for just longitudinal to be able to compare from a state perspective what our obesity rates are. Well, that's great, except it's just a statewide sample. So an example, and these, it was school nurses in this case, but anyone who's really pro-school health, we know it's every 3 years. That's not news to us. So we started working with the state health department early and said, well, what if we'll do the manpower, if we use the same standardization of how they're really, I mean, to make sure we do it the same way so we can compare it, if we follow those same protocol, would you help us get the other randomized schools that we need so we can get it in smaller pockets? And then would you help us analyze it? And they said, sure. They were thrilled because when they started this program years ago, they had to, you know, obesity is a sensitive topic. And years ago, people were really concerned why we would want to collect it. I know that sounds odd now, but, you know, those of us, we know that's the truth. So they're thrilled that we want to collect more now. And Utah, as Katie mentioned, depending on what stat you look at, we use, and not that this is something to brag about, but it's usually about one school nurse for about 6,000 students. So we're covering anywhere from 5 to 10 schools. And some of them are close by, but in our rural areas, it could be that there's 2 hours travel time that you've got to deal with too. So it's not like our school nurses are sitting around twiddling thumbs. Anyway, so they got, and they asked, they got, so this is the data from Weber School District, which has about 10 schools. The school nurses went in, and they collected it. Not only were they collecting it, but they wanted to do some interventions, and they wanted that baseline data that's so important. Oftentimes, we kind of think back and said, oh, we wish we knew how things started. And so they were able to do it because with the new school lunch program, they were making sure that all the school lunch programs really were being changed in their schools. And so they were trying to use it to help show so that they could then fight for school breakfast programs, which are still not regulated in the schools. So this is what, on the side there, figure two, it says that is actually, that just shows the first, third, and fifth grade, and you've got the state, meaning the state of Utah, and then next to it is Weber School District. That was the school district it was done. And we just have the data here. They have it by individual schools, but for this, we just did it by the district. And then they looked the same, all of this analyzed by the state health department, so that was great, looking at a difference between boys and girls. But they found there was no statistical difference between the statewide data and their school district. But at least they now know that, and they know what the rates are. Next, here are the schools. In Utah, they do individual, they call it the small areas, where they pick certain zip codes that are usually at high risk or something, and they collect extra data for that. It's probably something common done in other, I see head shaking. So these are the small areas that are in Weber School District, and they were able to break it down by there. So you can see the rates of obesity as well as rates of overweight. And the total from different, again, that was it statistically different, and it was not. There was no statistical difference. So, you know, nothing grandiose and huge, but they didn't know that before. And something that was already being collected, by simply collecting on a few more schools, they were able to get so much more information that they now can use and track their own areas with school lunch programs. They've also implemented some physical activities and different things. And finally, they also did look at it from race and ethnicity. And again, no statistical differences from how this is compared to the rest of the state, but still good to know and clearly some of the populations were had higher rates. So then they can do some targeting there. So one example there of how just with assessment to get them started as they're working through. The next example is another statewide database that actually, yes, it is in Utah, but it also actually is in many states now. And I have to apologize. The next two slides, I converted them, and I didn't get the right one. It's the correct information, but I'm annoyed because there's a typo. It's a zero instead of parentheses. Anyway, so sorry. But this is a voluntary system that a lot of states actually have some type of a form. It's not standardized, though. So it goes back to when trying to look across states, but working with those states, we've five or six different states now use the same form where they collect when there's been, and it's very broad, but it's a school safety form. It's when there's an injury. And basically, there's no right or wrong of when you can fill it out, but it's not like someone needs a Band-Aid. It's something pretty big that a form has to be completed, and it goes to the state health department or whatever agency is collecting that data. In Utah, it's voluntary, but they've been doing it since 1982, and the schools don't realize it's voluntary, and they always do it. So we've got this great, rich data. This here is showing, we've split it out between elementary school, which goes to sixth grade in our state, and then grade 7 to 12, and then total of some of the main injuries. This is just, and this the state reports on. But what they don't, there's all this rich database they never look at. For example, there was actually a study done in the Journal of School Health that looked at the data from 1990 to 97. So we took another seven-year period of up till 2010, and the injury rates, they went down slightly, but not from a statistical standpoint, no significance at all. And when you look across the different things, there's really little change. Now, yes, I come back from a school nursing background, and it's not per se that it's the school nurse that's going to fix it, but earlier in a presentation, we learned how many states are also cutting their facilities managers, which are your custodians and those that take care of the recess and the playground area. And over this time period, absolutely no change in the types of injuries and where they occur. It's a great public health project to see what we can do. I mean, yeah, of course, recess is most likely place for kids to have an injury, but some of the surfaces, indoor surfaces, were actually higher, and not statistically here, they averaged out, but I'm not sure if I actually put the slide in, but when you look at elementary school versus older kids, the older kids are getting injured more often, like during assembly time. You know, who would have thought assembly was the time? I don't know what they do in assembly that's so dangerous, but, you know, that's not something you would normally think of. So being able to use the data in just a different way than just tracking the types of injuries. And actually, in this same database, they actually do track the influence of the participation of the school nurse. Now, Massachusetts also collects this data, and this is something that's very interesting because in Utah, 911 is called four times a week somewhere in the state. Because we can go back to our ratios. We only have emergency care plans in place, and when in doubt, your first call is not the school nurse, it's 911, because you don't know where that school nurse is and how fast he or she's going to make it. So they actually found, using this data, we statistically found that if 911 was called and a school nurse was probably not involved at all, it was either a coach or a teacher or a secretary. However, in Massachusetts, it's the complete opposite, where they have a lot more school nurses, nearly a school nurse in every school, and those school nurses were able to, they actually found, getting the school nurse involved and doing some additional training, they were actually able to decrease the amount of times 911 was called because the school nurse was able to do better triage. And so when you think of costs of 911, in many states, Utah is one of the states you can call it and it doesn't charge you unless you're actually transported, but in some states, even calling them and them showing up is a cost. Maybe not on the school, but on the parents or whomever. And so it's a big cost savings that the Massachusetts nurses have been able to show simply by triaging and doing the job that they would normally do. Not so fortunate yet in Utah. But the data is available, and there's a lot that can be looked at it. The last one I want to talk about is actually, as has been mentioned, school nursing. And I have to watch my own time. I forgot I have a timer. Okay. Sorry, I'm almost done, and we're almost done. So school nurses are kind of that bridge we've been talking about with academics, and so we need those academic outcomes because that speaks to that group. But it's also we're in the world of health, and with the Affordable Health Care Act and being that bridge, the question has come, why is education basically paying for many healthcare treatments being done in the schools. And for years, traditionally, that is how it's been. Now, in the past few years, in nearly all states, in some form, participate in this, where they get they do a reimbursed Medicaid reimbursement for children with special health care needs. But looking at that model, and going back to the beginning when I spoke about the concern we have with common definitions, is this is a place that a lot of people have, and they've started collected the data on it, is using some of the common codes that Medicaid, even if they're not the special education children that we've been collecting the data on, but using those same codes across the board, or using similar codes like the ICD, we're on the 10 now, which is international classification codes or current procedural terminology codes. These are ones they use in the doctor's offices all the time. With those codes, there are financial amounts that go along with them, and being able to use that to actually show the return on investment. So it's not just that you're going to have a school nurse in a school who is able, in case there's an emergency, or hopefully helping with some of the things that, as we talked about, because again, my background being school nursing, what is sensitive that a school nurse really makes the difference? And this is showing we're actually something that's standardized that goes across the nation that we can compare, but not only that, but we're showing how schools are actually saving quite a bit of money, and actually parents are saving quite a bit of money from their insurances, because these are medical procedures that are already being done in school and have been gone in schools for years and years. We just have never really thought about it. With healthcare reform, though, schools are going to be forced to think about it, and we need to be on top of it as school health advocates to make sure that we keep the personnel that need to be there and that we're documenting it in such a way to show what we're doing and how much money we're actually saving. And the money can come back, if you're familiar with it, it's reimbursement, so it comes back to the schools. And many school districts use that money for additional school nurses. Vermont has actually had a, where they use reimbursement administration money, they actually are enrolling kids into Medicaid, and they've actually shown that enrolling them and making sure, because a lot of adolescents don't go to the doctor unless it's extreme urgency, making sure they get regular routine care, they're able to identify a lot of chronic conditions that they didn't know about, both physical as well as mental, behavioral health, and they've actually linked that back, and they're showing that there's a decrease in like suspensions and behavioral issues because of the link with medicine. So we've got to look at it from that broader standpoint. And that's kind of where we are. Already has been mentioned the need for standardized language. Electronic health or medical records will help with that, because we can also talk across and work together on it. And then in addition to that is the importance of getting some national studies. It's important to get the small ones, and that's so great and wonderful. But for us to be able to really show the impact and to show from a statistical research robustness, those national studies and that more robust research design, because we have the larger databases. So that's where we are, and I am done. So, good. So we now have 10 minutes if all the speakers want to come up, presenters, and we can just open it up for any questions that you have. I would like to remind you, if you haven't signed in, again, this is not because, if you want information, great, we'll give it to you. Oh, perfect, thank you. We've got one. We just want to know who's coming. And also the social tonight. You guys want water? There's water there. So is that any questions for anyone? Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My question's for you.
Oh, okay. Right. I'm just repeating it because it's being recorded, so I know most people heard it. So the question is, why are we using a measure such as absenteeism when a pediatrician wouldn't use that to show as an outcome for what they do? I would say I think it's partly is because school nurses work in two different worlds. Pediatricians work in the world of healthcare, and that's not the type of outcomes that they're measured or they're looked at. because school nurses, and a lot of school nurses are hired actually from the educational school district, and so their bosses are educators. And I'm not saying that that's, so we kind of work in two different worlds, and we kind of need to speak the languages of two different worlds. At the same time, I would not say that that is, and I think that was brought up before, it's something that people link with health a lot of times, and there's a lot of data that links it to health, but there's a lot of other factors too. So I don't think we should put all our eggs in that basket. Do you want to do it in the microphone, though?
I think, you know, part of what that brings up is the siloing of information. And, you know, if we look at not only the health of our nation, but the education, and there were several presenters earlier that talked about declining education outcomes and declining health, we don't measure up very well in terms of health or education in a worldwide sphere. So we need to start looking systemically at how do we get our children healthier so that in the future they don't have chronic conditions. And the way to do that is to get them better educated. And there are a lot of measures that link absenteeism to school connectedness, to graduation rates and success at school. So I think looking systemically is where we have failed to use the interventions that we have appropriately. We need to start doing that more.
But, you know, there's HIPAA and there's FERPA. And so it seems that they're, you know, in two different worlds. But obviously we have to address both areas in order to be able to, for the health community to share data with the educational community. And I didn't hear you all address that. Are there any examples of where we've been able to accomplish that?
I'm just going to repeat the question, and I'll let Katie answer it. The question has to do with HIPAA and FERPA and how that relates to what we're doing.
And I have to tell you, I don't have the answer to that, but if we step back and look systemically at this, both of those measures, and FERPA came first, are designed to protect the security and confidentiality of people's private information, whether it's health or education, and those are two really sensitive areas. And one of the reasons that I think promoting electronic health records are important is because of the sophistication of these systems. It's very, well, not very easy, as we were talking earlier, you know, the definitions of who gets access to what and what role, but putting firewalls or permissions based on your role is a lot easier in electronic records. So a parent can say, you know, yeah, it's great for the school nurse to have access to my data that's in my care provider's office, and yes, my school nurse can share data on my child's health room information with my care provider. We could do that individually. You know, as the parent logs into the system, they can say, yes, these are the roles that are allowed to have access to that data. So I think the distinctions between HIPAA and FERPA are going to become more blurred as we move forward with these processes, I think. And I, you know, that information, you know, that decision hasn't been determined yet.
I was going to comment, it depends on what you're using the data for. If you're using it to provide care for a specific child, then you get into stickier HIPAA and FERPA issues. For research purposes and the kind of things we're talking about here with aggregating data, the trick is how do you de-identify it? And if it's electronic, you know, it's easier to strip those identifiers out of it. And there are some hoops to jump through. I don't mean to sound like it's just a breeze, but it's doable, and we've done it.
Much more doable electronically.
And if it's de-identified, you don't have to go through all of the hoops of getting parents to consent to release data because it's not identifiable. And that's what, in the past, I know, has really been a brick wall for a lot of school-based projects. You simply can't get a hold of the parents to get them to agree. It's not that you're doing something particularly sneaky or egregious in any way. You just don't have the resources to get all of the consent. So if you can de-identify those data, and again, having them electronically, it's, you know, it can happen. It's just a matter of putting the resources into it.
Well, that's what we were able to do with the DION data. We were able to I presented some results of another study where we used the same School District of Philadelphia data several years ago, and a number of people came up to me and said, how did you get access to school data? Well, it was electronic. What was critical was that somebody within the school district in their data management group was able to do the de-identification for us. They held the code. We never saw the code. They assigned dummy identifiers to each one of our thousands of students that were in the database. We had no way of getting back to who they were. And we also satisfied the Thomas Jefferson University Institutional Review Board because we were using protected health information. Technically, we had month and year of birth, and that made it necessary. That and the fact that we were doing research with these data made it necessary for us to get IRB approval. But it wasn't a difficult thing to do, and so we were able to jump through those hoops, but it was critical that we could de-identify the data. And the resource constraint there was that somebody in the district had to do it for us. And when we decided to go ahead and in collaboration with Dr. Foster, we've actually gotten access to his data, which were collected under a research protocol and did have identifiers because they had individual consent. We arranged with the school district to do the match for us and assign our dummy identifiers to his cases because he still had student variables on student identifiers on his cases. Again, what was a time and resource constraint was that somebody in the district had to do it for us, not that we couldn't get approval. So that's a critical issue when you folks are dealing with that, is that somebody who is allowed access has to do the de-identification.
Practical question. When you were looking at school nursing and numbers of clients they serve, et cetera, when school nurses are precepting a student nurse, how do they record and how is that standardized? Because I know that happens all over the country. And does it muddy the waters at all? Do the kids there seem to get counted under the school nurse that's precepting them?
I'm repeating the question. You can answer it. So the question is a practical question on how do things like a school nurse who's being precepted get counted into the model when looking at ratios.
Actually, Erin's the expert on ratios, so she may want to address that piece. But I didn't look at specific instances. I looked at data collection instruments. I didn't look at individualized student data. I just looked at the instruments and what the variables were. And my goal there was how do we all start getting on the same page so that we can start talking on a national level about what's happening with kids. I think, though, the answer to your question is in an electronic health record, anybody who's documenting on that student should have their own unique identifier, their username, and their password, which is their proves that that's who it is. So that's part of that whole security and confidentiality that needs to go into your electronic data management that your district should set up.
I was going to say our time, we're actually over, but come up and ask individually any other questions or comments that you have. And thank you again for coming. We appreciate it.